Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Magical Musings. I am one of your hosts, Joy. Brian is on the other end of the line here. And today we're going to be talking about everything that the books don't talk about and trying to figure out how to convey it to you guys so that y'all are interested. So come on in, we're going to have a good time and grab your drinks, settle down, and, you know, relax. Tonight's episode is going to be the number 15th in the series, I believe, of and we're going to be talking about energy work as it relates to spell crafting. So this is a companion piece to last episode's talk about tying the theory of the spell crafting together with the practical. How to use the energy to get what you want out of the universe. So it looks like it's going to be a fun 2 hours, and I'm looking forward to it, kind of. Okay. First off, I have to apologize. Yeah, full enthusiasm. First off, I have to apologize. We did miss a episode, which means that this one's been delayed almost a month. That's my fault. The job that I have mundanely changed rules on me, and so the shifts changed, and I was trying to adjust to a new schedule and just not feeling very well last time. So this is to make up for it. We also have Kumiko, who is now in heat again, and she's going to be in my face constantly, and I'm probably going to be yelling at her at some point. So please forgive us for that. I'll try to cut it out wherever I can. But anyway, so energy work, this is one of those, this is another topic that a lot of the books, a lot of the tutors, a lot of the teachers hit, but kind of gloss over. Because unfortunately, most of this is experiential. It's not something that can be conveyed by talking about it. We can give the basics and we can give what you should experience and the theories about manipulating the energy and everything. But unless you really sit down and go into the trances and do the work yourself to have direct experience with these energy sources and how to manipulate them, you're not truly going to understand it. You have to start with an idea that metaphysical magic exists. Okay, you can't go into it going, oh, well, I'm going to manipulate all this energy around and magic doesn't exist, but I'm going to use all of this that I've learned to disprove magic and or to prove it in my own mind. It'll be counterproductive if you go in with that kind of attitude, because this is not something that you use to prove the theory. This is something where you have the hypothesis and you're using the experimentation to prove the hypothesis. Okay. So you can't be a skeptic at this point. If you're going to be getting into magic and spell crafting and manipulation and everything, you really have to be a believer. Or at least you have to convince yourself well enough to believe it and fake it till you make it. And, you know, that's kind of a requirement, and it's not something that you can skip over, unfortunately. So, as long as you start with that mindset, you're going to be okay. What exactly are we talking about when we talk about energy manipulation and the elements and everything? What we're talking about is essentially the force. We talked about this in the spellcrafting episode, and I still maintain that this is one of the best explanations of magic, mystical energy, metaphysical energy, elemental energy, energy work, the basis for magic ever made. And George Lucas is to be patted on the back for this forever. Magic, this energy work is a field. It is a field that exists on another plane that is created by everything that is alive and a lot of things that aren't, that is everywhere. It is all-encompassing. It is It is inside and part and parcel of every atom of our existence. And it is what connects us from where we are to something 800 billion trillion galaxies away. Okay? It makes us, it unifies us. Okay? He simplified it by saying it's an energy field created by all living things. It surrounds us. It penetrates us. It binds the galaxy together. And that's exactly what it is. The energy that I have in my body when I meditate is the exact same energy that exists however far away you want to imagine. And because that energy exists in the same state, we can use that as a stepping stone to get from where we are to there, no matter how big the distance is. Wormholes exist, just not as scientists have theorized them to do. It's not a physical matter thing that allows us to unify with the universe. It is a spiritual, magical thing. Okay? It is a life energy. Okay, so everything alive is part of it. Okay, even things that you wouldn't think are alive, if they have a personality, if they have a consciousness, they are part of this. So if you think that your car, who you've named and you babied and you've taken care of for many, many years, responds to you asking things of it or doing things or fixing things or talking to it, you're right, it does. Because that's the essence of this magic, okay? It is that connection between you and something else. Alright? Brian, do you want to add anything? Because I don't think I'm explaining this as well as I could, but it's a really hard thing to explain.
Well, I mean, I think the most common understanding of the whole idea of the presence that we in the Western magical traditions would consider magic is really well explained in tantric spirituality and in like Taoist spirituality as well as just kind of being the energy that is. I mean, Tom Brown Jr. describes it as the energy or the, what does he call it? The spirit that moves in all things. And when you reach a certain development level in spiritual traditions of any sort, there's an understanding that everything in the universe is a vibration of the same energy. That is the concept that, you know, you and I are the same. You and your worst enemy are the same, etc. So when you're working with magic, the idea is basically to create a vibration that will work on the level of what, you know, George Lucas called the Force, but which we understand as working in the spiritual level of reality where it's not physical in the sense that, you know, what you can touch in front of you is physical, but it's the subtle energy, the subtle energetic level of the universe that, you know, everything is united by. I don't know. It sounds probably just a repeat, but I can't think of simplifying.
No, it clarified a few things. Now, I'm going to suggest a term shift here. Instead of using a copyrighted term that isn't really copyrighted, but who everybody relates to Star Wars, we're going to stop using the Force. We're going to start calling it the Aethers. That is spelled A-E, and that's that weird letter where the A and the E are attached. T-H-E-R-S. And this is what the alchemists called the same energy source when they were working on it. It's the aethers. You send this energy out into the aethers. It brings things to you. This is the core of that way of doing spellcrafting that Brian and I were talking about in the spellcrafting episode, with the sending out the vibration to bring things to you. You set up a resonance in you, in the aethers, of your desire. And because it's all the same across however far you want, that resonance attracts like things of the same resonance to you. Okay? That's the magnetism that we were talking about. And this is essentially how you do it. A little more basic theory before we get into better explanations. First off, there's a lot of speculation on where this energy comes from. And I'll tell you where it comes from. It comes from us. It comes from everything. Okay? This is a cycle. Just like matter and energy in the physical universe can't be destroyed or created, energy in the etheric universe cannot be destroyed or created. It recycles. We have it as part of our life. It's one of the things that allows us to have a consciousness and to think. When that energy is used for various purposes, it is sent out into the universe through the etheric connection. Okay. Well, what winds up happening is that that energy is now out there. Okay, and it cycles around. Other people pick it up and gather it and use it and send it back out. And eventually, what winds up happening is it comes back to us. Okay, if you've ever heard the theory with the every piece of oxygen you've ever breathed has been breathed by other people because it's not created or destroyed. This is the same concept. The energy that you're using in your spell has probably been used multiple times by other people in other galaxies, in other universes for their spells, and it could have just, you know, been what was shed by a fire at one point as it was consuming a log, you know. So it recycles around, but living beings tend to shed it out of their body just like sweat, essentially. Okay, it's given off simply by being alive. People that don't know and don't use it and don't have conscious control over this will talk about, they'll get up in the morning and they're all energized and they're enthused and everything's going great and they'll go through their day and they'll get more and more tired and they'll get more and more grumpy. Their emotional state will change and they'll come home. And even though they're the same exact person and their experiences during the day didn't really, you know, amount to anything major or put them into a bad mood or anything, they're still tired, they're still cranky, they're grumpy, they don't want to have anything dealing with them. And this is because that energy that was in them, that was part of their spirituality, has been being shed out of their body throughout the day. And other people have been contaminating what is left in their body, okay, simply by brushing up against them. Okay, if you have five people and they're all sweating in the same very small contained area and they're moving around each other and they're interacting and they're touching and everything like that, sweat is going to transfer one to another. I mean, there's no way to avoid this. The same thing happens with the energy. It transfers one to another, and somebody else's negative mood or their negative personality is going to be transferred over to you, and your energy that's positive and up is going to be transferred over to other people. And slowly throughout the day, everybody is going to average into this one conglomeration of fuck it. Because that's, you know, what any group of people do. That's why you go out and you party. That's why you go to spend time with other friends, because then their contamination of your energy state will change your mind as well and get you into a better mood. Okay? And this is part of the natural process. There are things you can do. We're going to talk about that a little later in the episode. But this is where the energy comes from, okay? it's theorized by a lot of, by some people, that this energy will flow off of you like tiny little streams of energy and will collect in various points of the world. It will flow very naturally, very stream-like into flows and channels and go to various areas. It will collect and gather into pools. It will connect one group to another. And sometimes there's two thoughts here, two thoughts that I have, one that I learned and one that that I intuited that was confirmed by others. The first thought is ley lines. I know everybody has, if you've had any kind of education in metaphysics, in esoterica, you've heard about the concept of ley lines, okay? These are lines, these are essentially the nervous system and the circulatory system of the planet Earth. You have these straight lines connecting point A to point B, over inhumanly vast distances, that cause these two places to resonate together because they're connected by this, okay? The concept was come up with a long, long time ago. I don't know exactly who came up with it, but it's suspiciously straight for my taste, okay? From what I remember of the theory, you have Stonehenge is connected to New York City, which is connected to Los Angeles, which is connected to Istanbul by one line that goes in a direction. It's a random direction as to where they go. But eventually the line will intersect every single one of those points, okay, if you draw it straight enough for long enough. And on a globe, you know, you can see that. It doesn't matter, you know, that it's not going from directly from one place to another. It wraps around the planet five or six times. That's the way it's supposed to be. But eventually it will connect all of these. And then you have cross connections and back connections and things like that, which turn into the ley line map. Certain areas have a lot more connections coming into it, such as major cities, New York, London, L.A., Sydney, Australia, probably Frankfurt, Germany, and several other places like that, where you have all of these lines coming into it and intersecting. Supposedly these are points of power. Okay, where there's a lot of metaphysical energy available to anyone who wants to use it. Okay, this is a decent enough theory, except it leaves a lot to chance. Okay, and it doesn't follow observable nature once again. This is a scientific, we're going to project this idea onto this theory and use it to prove the hypothesis rather than using, or use the hypothesis to prove the theory rather than using the theory to prove the hypothesis, okay? Which I probably just screwed that completely up, but you know what? It's okay. So,
I think it makes sense.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think part of it is because you'll get a lot of, and I tend to steer clear of these kind of things, but when you read a lot of, let's say, conspiracy-oriented material, or you watch videos that relate to that sort of thing, what you end up finding is that the people who connect certain sites and spots and so on with, say, the Illuminati or other hidden, you know, groups that are supposed to be working on an occult level of reality, you get a lot of associations with cities like New York and so on, and London, and because the opinion that's usually given is that these places existed prior to cities, but I think what happens more often is that the pool of energy is formed and maintained through the occupation by people.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than the city being built on a power spot, the city itself becomes a power spot by existing and being a place where people work and interact.
Mm-hmm. And that brings us to the other theory of ley lines, which is not quite so linear. It's a lot more organic. And the way this was explained is in Mercedes Lackey's Heralds of Valdemar books, which has a lot of solid theory in it, and it's really good fantasy, and it's fairly light, even though she spends 800 pages doing character development and then 50 pages on the plot, and then the book's done. But the theory is solid, and in this, the sweat coming off of humans, of this etheric material, collects into streams. Those streams flow into creeks. Those creeks flow into rivers. Those rivers flow into pools, and then they flow out again. Okay? And in this case, you have not a straight line to be found. Okay? It is very much, if you took the heart, the human heart, and pulled all the muscle out and kept it so that only the capillaries and only the blood vessels were left. You have a human heart shape with these major areas that break down and break down and break down and break down and break down into almost these feather-like things, and then come back together and get stronger and stronger until it's back into the main thing. That's exactly what this theory of ley lines is. It is that feathery connection to all, and then it flows down and combines and combines some more and combines some more and combines some more until you actually have something that you can see and feel and manipulate that is the culmination of hundreds of thousands of single atoms of this etheric energy coming together. Okay? Because of this, it does follow natural landscape. It's not the landscape of the physical world, though. It's the landscape of the etheric world, once again, that flows together.
Well,
and go ahead.
Sorry. I was just thinking that brings to mind the concepts behind feng shui.
Mm-hmm.
In that the energy pre-existed human beings, and it flows by itself. Qi is just doing what it does. Mm-hmm. And the whole concept behind feng shui, or feng shui if you want to pronounce it more correctly, I believe, is the concept of adapting human architecture to the pre-existing energy. So instead of having to, I mean, ideally what you would do is build around the flow of qi, but instead what happens a lot, especially nowadays, when you get a consultation from an expert, is that they're using the principles of feng shui to counterbalance the perhaps negative flow or the problematic flow of qi through your house. So I think this tends to be kind of what certain aspects of magic do as well. Mm-hmm. It's not always about just going with the flow, literally, but kind of tweaking the flow so that it works in your favor.
Mm-hmm. And these lines and these flows can be changed. It takes a lot of very patient effort. But, I mean, when you talk about the essence of witchcraft, a lot of people are, you know, talking about how you use what's already there as how you, and you just guide it a little bit. That's what, you know, this is. That's what feng shui is. That's what these natural flows are. They're already there. You can manipulate them a little bit to what you want, but even a small change can have massive results if you're doing it right. You don't have to pick up the entire river and change its course. But if you change some of the way some of the feeder streams are coming into it, that could eventually put pressure on different areas, which will change the flow of the entire river that you wanted it to change in. Okay? So you have to understand the go ahead.
Sorry, it was occurring to me that basically with this water analogy, what magic is doing is creating an aqueduct mm-hmm. from a river so that you can make use of the energy that's mm-hmm. flowing.
Yeah, and it's not stopping it. It's not making a Hoover Dam. It's making a it's putting a water wheel into it so that the flow of the energy drives the water wheel, which drives your spell, which brings what you want. It's literally another tool. You know, once again, we're back to magic. It's a tool. It's not the whole tool bag. Now, some bright people out there are probably going to go, okay, well, if all of this energy collects into pools and sits there, where does it go? What happens? Well, there's a few answers to this. First off, these pools of energy tend to be highly energized areas like major cities that a lot of people get energized just by being around. It's like swimming in a lake. You feel better after you get out of it. You're cooler. You're more relaxed. Things like that. This is the same concept. You walk through this pool of energy. It's there. You feel energized. You feel alive. You feel better. You go throughout your day. That slowly wears away. You come back to it eventually. Okay. Most people don't even realize that they're doing this. But it's the same concept you get when you go to a concert. And you're there, you're not in a super good mood, you know, people are stepping on your feet and everything, and then the music starts playing, and everybody's focus is on the stage now. And everybody starts having a good time. And it doesn't matter that this 90-year-old grandmother just elbowed you in the face. You know, you smile, you hug her, you keep dancing to the music because everybody is up and bouncy. Okay, this is the same concept. It's the same energy, in fact. And it infects everyone. And once again, you've got that cross-contamination of energy from one person to another, and that collective pool of energy that is added to by the concert, by the people at the concert, by the people having fun at the concert in their emotional moods. Okay, so this pool will develop naturally. People will interact with it. They'll get feeling better. They won't know why. They'll go throughout their day. But if it doesn't get all used up, if people aren't constantly tapping into it and pulling off what they need for spells, then it's got this drain in it that goes to the etheric plane, to the astral, and it cycles through that in various ways, and then it comes back out through us living once again. And this cycle just keeps continuing. When it gets to the astral, a lot of times it's very contaminated energy. It tends to get cleansed through all the natural filters and everything. And believe me, if we tried, we couldn't contaminate all this energy because there's just too much of it. So, you know, people talking about, oh, well, this is a contaminated area. Well, the emotional stamp on the area is contaminated, yes, and that's what we're cleaning. The energy there is not, okay? This is all, you know, energy that will develop a personality of its own in an area, but once it moves away from that area, it'll start losing that personality, and it will just turn back into energy, okay? Let's see, what other things? A couple of things that I've noticed over time is if you do have energy that's very, very contaminated with negativity or death or whatever, if you take that energy and you give it to a snake, the snake gives back nothing but energy. They are a physical filter to that energy. I don't know why they developed this talent. I don't know how they developed this talent. I just know that it exists, and that's why you see snakes as healing creatures all the time, because they do literally heal energy. It's also one of the reasons why they're so phlegmatic. They just sort of lay there and go, okay, whatever. And they take this energy, they cleanse it, and they put out raw energy with, you know, nothing really. And that's why a lot of people that are depressed and sad like to handle snakes. That's why snakes are used in religious ceremonies and depicted on religious iconography all over the place. This is one of their purposes. Let's see.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was one of those things that when I realized what was happening, I went, wow, that's smart. And then I realized, well, wow, that's nature. It's going to come up with solutions.
Well, that certainly does make sense, considering the whole association with renewal and so on that snakes have because of, you know, their shedding of skin and whatnot, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never actually thought about it that way, but that is definitely interesting.
I mean, if you've ever have you ever handled snakes? Have you ever, you know, gotten a friend's boa and had him climb on you or something?
I don't really know a lot of people who have snakes, so no, haven't.
Well, lizards do it to an extent, but they're, you know, a little closer to super primitive survival instinct to do it all the time. Snakes tend to really do it just by breathing. And like I said, I don't know where they got this talent from, but, you know, nature's always going to come up with something to fix a problem that it may have. And contaminated energy is a very big one. You know, and so, and it was while I was handling a boa constrictor named Tetris that a roommate of mine had brought over, that I realized what was happening, because I was in a bad mood when I picked Tetris up at first, and it was like, okay, you know, this is stupid. She just abandoned this snake with me, and I don't know what's going on. And over about a half an hour or so, I really started feeling better. More alive, more alert, less foggy in the brain, and just, you know, and I hadn't done anything except hold the snake. That was it. And it was like, wow, okay, well, what just happened? And when I started analyzing it, I realized where all the energy went to and what had come back out, and it was like, oh, wow, one of those epiphany moments. So
intriguing. Huh, but I was now you make me kind of curious to handle snakes.
Well, it was also I was also in somewhat of a meditative mood. I mean, I wasn't going into it going, okay, I'm going to give all this energy to the snake and it's going to come back and da da da. No, I was just, you know, I just wasn't thinking about anything. I was watching TV, I think. That same kind of state that you fall into when you're using those chime balls. And you're rotating them around in your hand, you know, just okay, something to do. Anyhow, now that we've gotten off the topic again, one of the big things that we wanted to talk about on this episode, at least, is the elements. Now, depending upon your school of thought, they're anywhere from 4 to 27 elements, okay? And
holy crap.
Yeah, the Druidic is what I'm talking about, the Druidic elements, because there's 9 associations, and then there's an internal, external, and a physical associations. So 9 times 3 is 27. You know, face, sun in the south, okay, and everything like that, yeah. So you've got those, and those are the elements of the Druids. Wiccans and a lot of pagans tend to use the Hermetic elements, which is the alchemist elements of air, earth, fire, and water. And if you stop and look at everything, We're not talking about the polonium bending right now. We're just talking about the actual metaphysical elements. Okay, there are pieces of those four elements in every physical thing there is. Okay, just in your own body, you have the heat of your internal self, which is the fire of existence. You have the earth of the actual tactical skin and muscle and brain matter and everything like that. You have the water of the composition of your body. I mean, our bodies are 70% water.
The liquid part of everything, really.
Yeah, pretty much. And then you use air, you bring it into your lungs, and you use it to change things and to speak and as a catalyst. You know, and this is true for any object you want to name. Name anything, I could probably tell you how all four elements are related into it, and you know, make you probably go, huh, on some of them. But, you know, they're all there when you stop and consider it. Even Athames, the magical knives of the Wiccans. There are people that say that this is an air weapon. There are people that say it's a fire weapon. And I'm like, no, it's a combination tool. It is forged of the hardest earths you want to find. It is forged in fire. The fire changes it. It is cooled and quenched and set into its form by water. You hold it, you move it, you point it, you use it to direct energy, which is part of the air process. Okay? And that's got all four of them wrapped up into it. You can't make it just one element or another because it's all of them. I mean, smoke from an incense burner, from incense, you can say, hey, that's air, you know, because it is. But even then, it's got, you know, microgranules of earth, which carry the scent into your nose. It's burning, so that's fire, you know, and then you've got the water reaction that's being burned out, which is turning it into smoke, which is making the incense smoke. You know, so there you go again, all four. It's mostly air, yeah, but you can't say that it's all air. Anyhow, getting off the track here. A lot of Wiccans and a lot of pagans add another element in there, and that is spirit, okay? And this is the spark of Awen that the druids have, the fire of the head that causes consciousness, that causes thought, which, when combined with the other four elements, causes a person to exist. Okay? The spirit is what makes us people, what makes a cat a cat, what makes a fish, and makes a rock not be conscious. Okay? Because it doesn't have that spirit of that spark of spirit, even though there's a lot of people that say it does, but we're not going to get into that. The Chinese break it down into five other elements. They have, and I'm probably going to mangle this, earth, they have water, they have fire, they have wood, and they have metal. They don't have air in there for some reason. And I was always like, well,
air is considered part of the rest of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just part of the emptiness of the void of what is.
Mm-hmm. In the Hermetic traditions, wood and metal and dirt and rocks are all considered part of the earth. Because, I mean, you know, plant material grows out of the earth. It's woody. It's not metal. It's not anything. But the Chinese consider plant material to be its own element. And it's actually interesting when you start dealing with it on that level. Metal, because it is so hard, and it doesn't always come from the earth, and I'm talking specifically about meteoric metals at this point, is considered its own element as well. And when you break the metal out of the earth type and look at it on its own, it really, you can really see why they have it that way. The Japanese have air, earth, fire, and water, and void. Instead of spirit, they have void, which is the connection to nirvana, the attainment of oneness of spirituality. It's essentially the same thing. It's just the opposite side of the coin. Instead of it being everything, it's nothing. Okay? And that's the state that you drop into when you are meditating, when you are preparing your mind and your body for something, when you are shutting off the thinking section of your brain, and just going on instinct and reflex. Okay? And then there's various others, and I'm not going to go into all of them because literally every single people's has a different way of seeing the elements. Those are the most common ones, however. Okay? I'm going to add to this. In my personal practice, I have seven elements. Okay? A lot of people are like, seven? Why seven? Well, I'm going to tell you. You have air, earth, fire, and water. That's basic. Okay? I learned it just like everybody else learned it, that these are the four elements of creation. And then they snuck spirit in there, and I was like, no, that doesn't really fit. But then I started looking, and there's elements that contribute to us constantly that people just don't ever acknowledge. And that is the sun, the moon, and the stars. Okay? If we didn't have the energy of the sun, we would simply not exist. I mean, period. If the sun were not there, we would be traveling through space instead of orbiting the solar system. No plants would grow. We would be a frozen rock going in a straight line waiting to crash into something. Okay? The energy of the sun is abundant. It is free. It hits every part of the planet. It is what causes our consciousness. It is what causes the plants to grow. It is the thing that causes the wind to blow. Science has confirmed this over and over and over again. Okay, so you have to acknowledge that as a power source and a source of etheric energy. Okay, Brian, you were about to say something?
No, I was just thinking about that because, I mean, the sun is really the source of everything that we understand as part of the planet. I mean, mm-hmm. without it, there wouldn't be wind, there wouldn't be currents. I imagine that if you go far enough back, the dust that formed the early Earth wouldn't have clustered together at all, and so on and so forth.
Well, you know, also Sagan says that, you know, we're made up of stardust, and we literally are. The elements that are in our body came from solar system someplace. It's the same stuff that composes our sun, so literally we are the sun, okay? There's, you know, no escaping it. Then you get the moon, okay? Now, a lot of people get this attitude of, well, the moon is just a rock that reflects the sun's sunlight, okay? But if you actually ever listen on a clear night to the moon and just the moon, you'll hear that the energy is so different. It's the same photons and the same light that is coming off the sun, and then it's hitting the moon and reflecting back. But in impacting the moon and coming back at us, for some strange reason, this virulent, vibrant, commanding, demanding, chaotic, overwhelming fire of the sun gets changed into this gentle, comforting, cool, crystalline feeling when it comes from the moon. It's one of the reasons, one of the big reasons why I am a night owl, because when the sun is in the sky, I find it incredibly hard to think because there's this constant hissing in the back of my head when I'm doing anything magical that is massively distracting. It's like somebody's got this, the static that you get on your TV That's exactly what it sounds like, just amplified. And as long as the sun is in the sky, I hear it. When the sun is not in the sky, it's like, oh, thank God, it finally shut up. And I get this pingy crystalline type sound from the moon. And it's really, really interesting. You know that in a lot of movies and a lot of TV shows where they have this this tinkly sound that's associated with ice caves? That's exactly what it sounds like. And when you stop and consider that the moon is responsible for the cycles of the ocean in the tides, you go, wow, respect, you know, because the moon really does a hell of a lot of work. And it's a separate source of energy, okay, that you can draw from when you need it. Wiccans have been doing this when they call upon the goddess for decades. You know, moon, please bless our whatever. That's exactly what they're doing. They're pulling energy from the moon to put into whatever. The last is the stars, okay? And I take the stars collectively. It is everything out there that is not the planets in our solar system, not our moon, and not our sun, okay? It is everything else that's out there. And when you hold it collectively in your mind and you think about it, there's so much there that you cannot ignore it as an energy source. It becomes collectively this massive amount of infinite energy, because if the sun is infinite energy that's close to us and blowing up, hundreds of quadrillions of gigaplexes of infinite amounts of stars out there are collectively that much more powerful than the sun. You know, it's literally a power source you cannot exhaust. And where the moon is cool and silver, the universe and the stars become this platinum color and this platinum feel. They're there. They are waiting to be used. It's not a sound associated with it. It's not a feeling. It's just a preponderance of, oh my God, there's all this there. It's incredible. Okay? So you have to really count those three additional elements in there, because there's no way that you can ignore them. At least, you know, if you're working with energy, I don't think that there's any way that you can ignore it. So that's, you know, and as I was working with elements and as I was working with energy, you came to these understandings of these seven elements, okay? And if you think about it, seven is a prime number. It's also an exceedingly magical number, okay? We have seven three-dimensional directions. And a lot of people go, no, we've got three dimensions. That gives us six. But you're not thinking about one. You've got before, behind, left, and right, above, below, and within. Because within your own soul is another direction as well. And you can't ignore that one.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, and I mean, in a lot of, at least in my own personal sort of spiritual practice, whatever it may be lately, I tend to use the seven directions that are associated with native spirituality, combined mm-hmm. with the hermetic elements. In that, you know, above and below and within are part of the equation. And I think that almost any spiritual tradition that relates to energy on any level does discuss the concept of the within as being a pivotal part of the entire thing, because mm-hmm. there isn't really a separate state of, you know, the within from the without, because mm-hmm. unless you have that consciousness to interact with it, there is nothing out there.
And that's where you get the concept of spirit. That's why when it was first presented and it made a nice little tidy pentagram, it was like, okay, and I understood it intellectually. It didn't solve the entire problem for me, though, because the within is where the spirit is at. And so when you add the above and below and within, you get that. You get the, with the gestalt of above and below and within, you get the spirit. Okay? You get that central focus point. What tends to freak people out is the model that I use, and it's not one that, it's one that's kind of hard to describe. It's really a visual thing. Imagine yourself standing vertically, just hanging in space, okay? The direction that is, that the person, that your eyes are pointed is before. That is the north, let's say. The direction that is, that your back is at is obviously behind. You have the left and you have the right, okay? So those are all on one plane, okay? Above is literally above your head, okay? Below is literally below your feet, okay? And then the within is inside of your own body. Now, put the hermetic elements on the level that your eyes are at. You put air in the north. You put earth behind you. You put water in the east, which is to your right. You put fire in the west, which is to your left. Now you put the sun over your head. You put the moon below your feet, because normally those two switch all the time. The sun is in the sky, the moon is not. The moon is in the sky, the sun is not. I know that's not completely accurate, but that's the way the myth works. And then all the stars are within you, because you are made up of the same matter that the stars are made up of, okay? And then when you get that model fixed in your head, you start realizing the interplay between them. Because it's not just, okay, the air is opposite the earth, and they're, you know, they're antithetical because they don't exist in the same place at the same time. But you also get, okay, the air is between the sun and the moon. And when you stop and consider on a physical level and a metaphysical level, it is. It really literally is between them. And the sun and the moon create and support air in a metaphysical sense, because the sun is all the energy, the moon is all the coolness. And so you have that fire and that cool together, and that's what causes the winds. That cycle of heating and cooling. And the same thing for water and fire and even earth on some occasions, because the earth is influenced by the gravity of the sun constantly. And the moon orbiting around it pulls on the water, but it also pulls to a more limited extent on the tectonic plates, which causes it to shift. So you start seeing those interplays also. And you see how every single one of those elements start interrelating to the stars, which are within, because it's the same thing that's playing out in billions of other places in the stars. And so you get all that turning around too. This was when it finally sprang full-blown into my head. It was like, oh, fuck. Oh, wow. And then I started seeing the same structure in other places. Brian, did you ever work with the four regions of Ireland in Druidism?
Marius, etc. I personally never did, no.
Okay. But you know about them, right? Now,
I vaguely do, yes.
Okay, take Connaught and the Munster and Leinster and all those, and put them in the place of the four classic elements, okay, with you standing in the center as Usna, or the Hill at Terra, okay? Now duplicate that up one level where the sun is at, and then duplicate it down a level where the moon is at, okay? Now you have the sky, the land, and the sea. And you have a vertical structure now. and you have those same elements replicated in the sky as you do on the land, as you do in the sea, below your feet. And this is another basic concept of Druidism, and when it hit, it blew my mind again. Because this is the same thing. You know, it's just replicated on a different level. And then the concept of the bright world and the constant moving upwards through life lessons and stuff to advance from one level of death to another level of death to another level of death with the constant cleansing as you move up made sense. And I went, oh, wow. all from this.
Well, and I think the whole concept that I'm familiar with, at least, tends to see all of life and personal spiritual evolution as a spiral anyway. So it totally does make sense that, you know, one level would link to the next, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, in every case, you're going to be going through the whole cycle of a circle through the process, and then you go upward and, you know, do the circle again and up and so on. So, yeah, it totally makes sense.
Okay. Now, this is the point where I'm going to say we do something super typically pagan and give you all the correspondences for everything, and then we're going to do something unique for us and say, no, we're not giving you any correspondences. Because what's going to happen is as you work with this structure, this basic air, earth, fire, water, sun, moon, stars structure, you're going to find your own set of correspondences with this. Okay, where you actually place the air, earth, fire, and water on the level that your eyes are at doesn't matter as much as where it fits for you. The energies from each of these are very, very different in flavor and in texture. Earth energy is very ponderous. It's very there. It's also very fertile. It's very easy to manipulate in certain ways and at certain times. It's really hard to get going in other directions, and once you get it going that way, it's damn near impossible to stop. The air energy, on the other hand, is extremely easy to start, extremely easy to stop, but you've got to pay constant attention to it and make sure that it stays on topic. Because if you don't, it's going to go 5,000 different directions, and it's just going to dissipate everything, and you're never going to get back together again. Fire energy is very close to air energy in that it's extremely easy to start, it's extremely easy to stop, but it is really hard to control, and you do have to pay attention to it, okay, just like a campfire. Water energy tends to try to get into everything. And if you think about the nature of water, nature is in literally every single substance that is a physical thing. There's other things that you have to think of also. Water and air are mediums for life to live in. Okay? Fire and earth are mediums for things to live with. Okay, you cannot have air and earth in the same place because they don't combine at all. They can coexist around each other, but they cannot become one unified thing. Okay, you can't take if you think about this, the way a field is, there is either dirt there or there is air there. It is not a combination of both. However, water and earth can combine very readily. You get mud. And, you know, earth and fire combine really readily. You get ash. You get lava. Okay? You get air and fire working together, and you get smoke. If you have air and water together, you get clouds. Okay? So there's those interactions. The reason that I put air in front of you, earth behind, water to one side and fire to the other is because it's a cycle. air and water, or air and earth can't exist in the same place, and neither can water and fire. They cancel each other out. They are naturally antithetical. Each element, however, creates and is supported by the two elements next to it. Air is created by fire and coexists with water. Both of those are together in and of itself. Earth creates fire, gives it something to burn on, and air comes from fire in the form of smoke. And you start seeing those relationships also. But you also start seeing the classic Hermetic element symbols. If you've ever looked at them, there are a series of triangles, some with lines, some without, some with the point up, some with the point down. And I'm going to give you the key to it now. Imagine in your head this structure. Air in the north, water to the east, earth to the south, fire to the west. Okay? This is the mandala. Keep this in mind. This is the basic concept. Earth's symbol is an inverted triangle with a line through it. Okay, so put that in the south. Air's symbol is an upright triangle with a line through it. So put that in the north. Okay. East and west, water is an inverted triangle with no line. Fire is an upright triangle with no line. Okay, so now we've got those arranged, but here's why. Earth settles. It goes as far down as it possibly can get. If you go down to the bottom of everything, you're going to find Earth there. So Earth is at the bottom. That is why it points down, because it is going down. Water always flows to the lowest point it can get to, okay, which is why it is point down. Air rises. It sits on top of Earth, and it sits on top of water. It does not go under that, so it is at the top with the point up. Fire, if you remember a burning campfire, rises. Therefore, that point is up. Now, Earth is a floor. There is nothing under Earth, nothing else under Earth except more Earth. So it is the bottom. It is the hard deck of everything. Okay? Nothing exists outside of the air canopy. You can't have fire, you can't have water outside of it, without a container, outside of the canopy of air. So it is the ceiling. That's why those two have lines through them as hard decks. Water and fire don't have that because they exist in between the ceiling and floor. So now you've got the key to how those symbols are arranged and why. What do you think?
Interesting. No, that's interesting. I'm just trying to keep the mental picture of that arrangement in mind. Because I tended to use, like, the traditional, you know, northeast, southwest, earth, air, water, fire, or mm-hmm. earth, air, fire, water association. So I'm basically just sort of perceiving things as you've described them and trying to hold that image in my head.
Does it make a little more sense, though?
It does, I suppose, when you use those symbols, because I tend not to, but... It does make sense, and I'm pretty sure that I've considered the arrangement of those based on that exact kind of principle as well. Because I always did find it weird that, like, the symbols were so obvious in the way that they're pointed, and the circle usually isn't arranged in that way.
Mm-hmm. I think this is one of those cases where Mike Nichols had this point, Air in the North, in one of his articles. But I think this is one of those cases where the lore was deliberately screwed up when it was taught, when it was written down, to hide the mystery from others. And unfortunately, the true teaching of the arrangement that I've got was lost over time because that was an oral teaching, and that was, okay, you're reading this here, that's screwed up. This is what it actually is. And when you start looking at other factors, like the sex of the, that's associated with the various elements, the colors, the ways that you're supposed to interact with them, the directions for the physical layout, it becomes really obvious that it's messed up somehow, because the classic teaching out of the Books of Shadows starts going, okay, this is where it's supposed to be, and this earth is in the north and air is in the east and fire's in the south and water's in the west. Okay, that makes sense to a point, but it's not completely, because when you look at the geography, you know, there's not earth in the north in England. There's ice and cold. And earth is considered fertility. And that's not what you associate with a northern mentality. You associate cold and distance and hardship. And what do you normally associate those qualities with? With air. So shifting air into the north becomes almost, you know, required at that point. And that means that, you know, earth is now in the east. Well, earth and air, you know, interact with each other. But fire in the south, you know, yeah, you can say, okay, the south is down there, it's a lot warmer and everything like that, and that counters the air. And that's a good arrangement, and it works. But when you start thinking, okay, well, earth and air don't coexist with each other, they are antithetical to each other, they're the ceiling and the floor, it makes more sense to put them opposite each other. You know, but that was just, that was my rearrangement, because it made more sense. And a lot of other people went, you know, it does. So, you know, it's if you want to use it, please do. Find your own associations with all of these, because I can give you the rules of where to put them and what to associate with them and what qualities they each have. And for every single time I'm going to do that, there's going to be five other people that say, no, you're wrong. I've got them associated.
Well, and that goes.
Go ahead.
Sorry, that goes back to the little story I was telling last episode, where the woman messaged me specifically asking for a spell on how to do such and such, and I gave her my own personal experiential associations and, you know, my recommended colors and tools and whatnot for the spell. Mm-hmm. And she went, well, you know, I have my own associations. And then, you know, the spell didn't go anywhere near what she expected it to. It totally turned the situation around on her and just made it worse. Mm-hmm. And then she turned around and blamed me for it. And I was like, well, you know, I told you this is my experience, and I outlined the spell clearly for you and said, I've never had any problem. And she, you know, had her own associations and whatnot, and she just did her own thing anyway. And I was like, well, you know, okay, if those had actually worked for you in the past, then the spell should have worked.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, it's a matter of, like, as you do more and more work with it, you're going to discover certain things make more sense. They work better for you in certain arrangements. And everyone is different. However, again, there are, you know, with enough experience, you'll be able to introduce people to different concepts and have them work effectively for them. Up to a point, obviously.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like,
you know,
this.
Again.
That's,
well,
that's,
exactly.
That's what all this is. You know, it's us explaining what we've come to and then going, go find your own.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the reality is that if magic is something that you want to work with and practice and continue doing, then as you do more and more work with it, you're going to discover things that suit you better than others, you know, and not everyone is going to agree. Sometimes people disagree based on tradition, you know, etc. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's all a matter of personal experience.
Oh, yeah. And that's, you know, that's where it's good to have a common background for education on some of these, because it does give you a starting point to work from. Please make sure that you understand this. We are not down on the classic means of teaching things, the classic lore, because the classic lore is there for a reason, okay? This is alternative ways of looking at some of the same information and also giving the explanations behind the mysteries. Because let's face it, human beings are curious creatures. We always want to know why. We always want to know what. We always want to know the five W's and the H. Okay? So, we're constantly experimenting. We're constantly changing our perceptions of the universe. Getting the basic information out of the 101 stuff is great. That gives you a solid foundation to start from, to start asking the whys and hows. What happens, though, is that it has become so ossified by people who have a vested interest in keeping the lore from changing, publishers, that it doesn't change, and there's no growth beyond that. And this, the 101 stuff is like, is in a lot of ways a spiritual type of karate. Okay, in karate you have the white belt, you have the yellow belt, you have whatever ranks of belts you have all the way up to black, okay? And you progress through these and you have tests and you have information that is given to you and that is done and then you get your black belt. And most karate masters and most karate schools will look at you at that point and say, okay, now that we've got the basics out of the way, now that we've got your foundation done, you can finally start studying the deeper parts of the mysteries and learning more and learning how to incorporate it to you. That's what the black belt symbolizes, is that you've completed the basics. Well, the 101 stuff and most of the craft up to getting your third degree initiation is going through the white belts to the black belt. When you get your third degree initiation, you're supposed to be starting on the path of self-discovery now. You've got the basics out of the way. Now you can take it from there and incorporate it into your life. That's what Magical Musings is about. This is what we're trying to show, is the stuff that's after you achieved your black belt, and the whys and wherefores, and what works for us, and how you can start incorporating it together. Okay. Brian? No, nothing.
That sums it up quite nicely. I'm going to have to go back to my little email about the outline of the show.
Well, right now we're...
I'm sure we can move into other things.
Well, now we can. Because next what you've got is you've got the actual energy itself, okay? The energy, yes, we said, comes from the seven elements. It's shed by human beings. It's contaminated by others around you. And this is where we get into some of the basic common sense stuff that people stop teaching for some reason. The common sense stuff that I'm talking about is things like grounding and cleansing and smudging and cleaning, and how to do it and doing it for yourself. A lot of people get affected by moods around them that other people are feeling. And this is normal. This is natural. There are ways to stop it from happening. There's ways to correct it. The easiest way to fix this is a shower. Just taking a shower, letting the water run over you and around you and through you, and take all that physical sweat as well as all that metaphysical sweat away. That's why you get into the shower, you're feeling like crap, you say, oh God, I don't want to take a shower. And then you get out of the shower and you're like, hey, it's a nice bright world. It's a great big universe and we're all really puny. And... You have a good time. That's
true.
Why. The water cleanses all of that contaminated energy off you and rinses it down the drain. And it's going to go someplace. It's going to go into the water table. It's going to go into fishes. It's going to go into the plants in the water. And someday you might eat it again. Okay? But that is the quickest and easiest way to cleanse all of that energy off of you. This is the purpose behind luminal baths in some traditions of Wicca. In Jewish tradition, this is the part of the ritual preparation for a major spell, is cleansing yourself. That's to get all of this crappy contaminated energy off of you and to and basically reboot your body back to when you woke up in the morning. Okay. Another really easy way to get rid of all of this energy, especially when you've got too much. There's times when you're working on a spell, you're working on a ritual, you go through and raise all of this energy and you're just vibrating and everything and you send all this energy off and you're still floaty and still disconnected and still, oh, wow, look, my hand. It has a thumb on it, and I can pull the thumb across my hand and touch my opposite finger. That's so cool, you know, and getting fascinated by trivialities like that. This is a side effect of massive energy overload. You've taken in so much energy that you're still disconnected from reality. You haven't sent it all off. You're not tired. You're still bouncy. Everything is still sacred in your brain. So what you have to do is you have to get rid of the excess energy. And the easiest way to do that is called grounding. Essentially, you sit down on the ground, tailored fashion with your legs crossed. You put your hands on the ground next to you on either side. You close your eyes and you imagine that your butt is growing roots out of it down into the earth and sending out little rootlets and everything like that. And then you just relax. Let the energy drain out through your root system into the earth and go away. And you will get energy back from the earth. It will come up through your root system, back into your body, and you will normalize. And you will be reconnected to the planet. You still may be a little goofy, but you won't be as scattered as you were, okay? You will have the energy that you need to continue your day. If you want to do it quickly, there's a martial arts technique where you stand with your hands loose next to your sides, your feet shoulder width apart, you close your eyes, you cup your hands so that it's like you're lifting water from where your hands are hanging next to your thighs. You bring your hands up across your abdomen and up your chest towards your head. As you breathe in, just a very... And then when you get as much air in your lungs as possible, you turn your hands over so that they're facing palm down and you push down towards the ground at the same time as you breathe out. That is exactly the same exercise. This is called centering, where you bring the energy in your body up to a central point, and then you push it all out into the ground. Okay? These are two of the easiest exercises to do for instant stress relief, for instant calm, for an instant way of reconnecting yourself to the land, to what matters. It focuses you. It gets your mind into a here and now position. And it also, the act of bringing your hands up and pushing down acts as a squeegee, an energetic squeegee on your body, and rips all of that extra energy, that energy sweat, the etheric sweat, off of your body and pushes it down into the ground. Okay? There's a couple of other tricks that you can use. One of them is, after a ritual where you're still floaty and scattery, is eat something. Okay, the best thing to get you refocused on your body is to make your body focus on itself. eating something says to your stomach and to your brain and to your mouth, hey, we've got food here that we've got to deal with. We don't have extra energy to float around and look at all the pretty colors around the stars. We've got to digest here. So let's bring it home, boys. Let's get together in our huddle. We're going to bring all of this energy back in, and we're going to digest this egg. And you ground nearly instantly. And it really, really works. So those are some, you know, quick things that you can do. There, you can make it a lot more ritualized if you want. Tai Chi is essentially the same thing as the bringing the hands up and pushing down to the ground. It's exactly the same flows. Qi energy exercises with any of the Chinese martial arts does the same thing. There's a lot of Japanese martial arts and Okinawan martial arts that do this before the practices. If you think about it, you do it when you go into a meeting. You're walking up to the meeting, you got your laptop, you got your pens, pencils, paper, whatever, and you stop just before you go in the door. You take a deep breath and release it. Same thing. Just without the hand motions. But you got to do it with consciousness.
Yeah. Well, that's just it. I mean, the whole focus of working with energy is that you will it to do what you need it to do. And one of the things that I tend to find helps is if you happen to be in or close to a natural space or a garden or something, is to just connect with plants, because plants are naturally grounded, obviously, growing mm-hmm. up from the dirt. So if you find it, you know, if you find that you're close to plants or trees or whatever, touching plants or flowers or even hugging trees can be a very grounding experience as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, if you don't have time for the full sitting down and closing your eyes and growing your own root system into the ground, you can lean with your spine up against a tree and let the tree use its own ground root system to do the exact same thing. You know, it's because especially, I don't know about you, but sitting tailor fashion on the ground in a skirt is just not happening. So, yeah, leaning up against a tree does the same thing. And a lot of times, you know, it'll balance you out. The trees actually will give you something a little extra. It'll give you a little bit more of an awareness of the area than you had before. You can choose to ignore it if you want or not, but shamans use it all the time. So do a lot of tree-hugging neo-pagans. You know, it's the same basic thing. Cleansing the energy, I mean, we already talked about giving it to a snake. We already talked about giving it to plants. You really don't want to give it to anybody else, another person, because you're not fixing the problem with the energy. You're just passing the problem along to someone else. So if you have, let's say, a headache, which is caused by an energy imbalance, by the way. A lot of them are. And you don't want to do the whole meditation, and you don't want to take Excedrin for it or whatever. Letting somebody else take it just is not a very good idea unless they know what they're doing with it. I had one priestess take a migraine from me. We were at a ritual. The ritual was over. I started seeing halos around things. I knew I was getting a migraine. She noticed that I was hurting and said, are you okay? And I went, no, I'm getting a migraine. We need to go home. She said, well, I don't want you to go home. And I'm like, well, I got to lay down someplace in the dark so that this migraine goes away. And she's like, no, here, I'm going to give you a penny. And she reached into her purse and pulled out a penny and put it in my hand. She then said, now, I just bought your headache from you. And she reached over to my head where it was hurting and grabbed hold of something, not my hair, and pulled. And there was this energy in her hand that I could see and I could feel. And she's like, okay, Now, I just bought your headache from you. It's in my hand. You see it in my hand, right? And I'm like, uh-huh. She said, it's my headache, right? And I went, uh-huh. She said, I can do with it what I want, right? And I said, yes. And she immediately slammed it into the ground with her hand. Just rotated her hand open and slammed her hand down on the ground. And the energy of the headache went in there, and I didn't have the headache anymore. It was like, fuck. A lot of it was
interesting.
Yeah, a lot of it was psychological, but the actual energy part that was causing it was very effectively gotten rid of. Now, the giving me money for it and having me confirm that it was now her headache because she bought it was tricking my mind into not claiming it again. Because now it was her headache. She bought it. It belonged to her. It's not mine anymore. And so she can get rid of it. And so then my subconscious doesn't go, no, I'm supposed to have a headache, and grab it back and pull it back into me. It was a pretty extreme spell. It was one of the neatest I've ever seen. But that's you know.
That totally makes sense, though.
Uh-huh.
Because, I mean, the whole concept with vitalism, actually, or Reiki, or a few others that I can think of, tends to be the idea of transfer of energy. And sometimes it's a matter of giving energy to someone who needs it, and sometimes it's a matter of taking it away.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, realistically, there are sometimes energy deficiencies that people suffer and don't realize that is the cause of their problem.
Mm-hmm. So, having talked about grounding to earth and grounding through water with the showers and luminal baths, we're now going to talk about grounding with air. And this is a technique called smudging. The Native Americans have had it for centuries. Essentially, it is a bundle of herbs that is tied together and then burned, and the smoke is wafted over you. It's like an extreme version of incense purification, except this is a rather large bundle of herbs, and it smokes hideously. I know you've probably seen it in some movie at some point where the Indian has this bowl of burning something in his hand, and he's got this little these feathers that are made in the shape of a fan, and he's brushing this over people. This is the same concept. That's actually a peyote ritual, but it's the same thing. You have the burning herbs, you're fanning them over people, and what's happening is smoke is coming in purified, it's hitting your body, and it's taking that energy, that contaminated energy, away from you. Okay, it's another version of doing a shower. It's just using smoke instead of water. Now, you have to be careful with this. The reason that I'm saying this is that it's very, very easy to retain all of the energy and just add the smoke energy to your already contaminated energy. You actually have to consciously let it go. I don't know however many people have seen Frozen, but there's the song Let It Go where Elsa's singing and she throws off a glove. And then she unhooks her cloak and it blows away in the wind. That is what you have to do. You have to literally get into a mental state where you are letting that energy go away with the smoke. There's I heard of another person who had a similar way of cleansing themselves by going out into a very windy area and just standing there, arms outstretched, eyes closed, and letting the air blow on them. And what they were doing is the mental image they had was all the energy that was contaminating them was blowing off like dust and vanishing into the wind. And they would rotate and the energy would blow away and they would, you know, and after a little bit they were cleansed. And so that's another way of grounding the energy, cleansing the energy into the air. Okay. Now, everybody's going to be, well, I don't want to walk through a fire. Well, you don't have to. The druids have known how to cleanse with fire for some time, and they do it by having two bonfires that you go between. They do this with the cattle in rituals all the time, and it's a way of blessing them. The heat and the light from the fires are concentrated in one area between them, and as you go through them, it burns off all of the contaminated and bad energy, leaving you with nothing but the pure. You get hot, you get warmed up, this is all good, okay? If you are into extreme body makeover, yeah, firewalking does the same thing. The Polynesians know this and have used it for quite some time. If you're not comfortable doing it that way, a campfire that you turn in front of while having all of the energy burn off of you is the same thing. The part of the sanctification of the circle has carrying the light around the circle to protect it, and in some cases moving the candle flame around you. Same thing. Okay? But you can purify yourself with any of the four elements. Not a lot of people realize this. They know that they can ground by sitting on the earth and letting the energy flow out, and that's what they think is the only thing that they can do. But what's wrong with if you're feeling bad, can't get outside, you're in a meeting, going and standing in front of the air conditioner for a little bit and turning slightly? That's grounding into the air. It'll cleanse you just as well. Throwing some water up on yourself from your drink and letting it rain down upon you as a symbolic washing free of the energy. You know, the extremes, you know, are to go and stand in a waterfall and let, you know, the water pound you, and you're in the ritual robes and it's ice cold and, you know, you're freezing. But after a while, your body adjusts and the temperature changes and you're not freezing anymore. It's just the water and you flowing all the energy away. Same things. Okay? So these So these things are some of the stuff that you need to keep in mind when you're working with this energy, because I will guarantee you, when you start working with energy, when you start doing spells on a regular basis, you are going to hit this energy imbalance and you are going to have to normalize yourself somehow. These are the ways that you can do it. If you can't get outside, take a shower. If you can't take a shower, stand in front of the AC. If you can't do that, light a candle and concentrate on the flame and the energy hitting you. Eat something.
Or do it with the sun, if that happens to be.
Well, if you're doing it with the sun, you're outside. You know, grow roots from your feet. That's the great thing. Humans are not elementals.
Open the window.
Mm-hmm. One of the greatest lines that I've ever read was from Robert Asprin. Oz, the mentor, is talking to Skeeve, his apprentice. And Skeeve has been is suffering from an energy deficit because he's been told how to connect into the ground ley lines and how to pull energy in from that, except he can't find one now in the area that he's in. And Oz looks at him and says, well, why not use something else? You're not a damn elemental. You're not limited to one. You're human. You're made up of all four elements. You can find an air ley line. You can find a fire ley line. You can find a water ley line. Tap into that. And it was like, wow, so simple. And he's right. We're not elementals. We can pull from all of them, okay? Now, having talked about all of those, and these are also outstanding ways, by the way, of connecting to those elemental energies without having to go through a whole ritual to do it. If you're outside and the wind is blowing and you need energy for a spell and you are pulling from air, it blowing over you is a fantastic way to get all that energy into you, okay? And at the same time, it cools you off and cleanses you as well, you know, so you got the same thing. We're going to talk, or at least I'm going to pontificate for a while, on shields and wards at this point, okay? This is a basic exercise that everybody should learn. I think, at least second day in any Wiccan tradition training, right after History of Wicca. You have the introduction, then you have Chapter 1, which is History of. The very next thing that should be taught is Grounding, Centering, Shields and Wards. Okay, because it's that important. Shields and Wards do two Definitely. Things. They do two things. They isolate you from energetic things around you, and they contain your energy. Okay, a shield is something that is on you. Wards are on a place. They're the exact same thing, and they're cast exactly the same way. One is just more personal than the other. So the basic means of creating a shield is to gather the energy however you will, from whatever source you want, from yourself, from the elements, from the sun, moon, stars, doesn't matter. Once you feel you have enough energy in the core of you, where your heart usually is, or your heart chakra at least, this is called your hara, in fact, you have this little ball of energy. What you do with that ball is you start expanding it and making it larger. Now, you're not adding any energy to it. What you are doing is you are hollowing it out. You are making it a bubble instead of a ball. So it goes from being a golf ball to being a tennis ball, then to a volleyball, and then it gets larger. And pretty soon, you have the bubble you're standing inside, made out of the energy that you just collected, and you are inside it. Now, the advantage to casting it this way is that all the negative everything that is in you has been pushed outside of that bubble. And all that is left inside the bubble, since it started with you, is yourself and your best everything. Okay, all the negativity stays outside of the shield. That is the purpose of a shield. It is to insulate you from everything around you, everything that's negative. Well, in order to do that, it pushes everything out. You are now standing inside the bubble, and the bubble can be shrunk down to a bodysuit on you. I know that people have seen sci-fi movies, and the concept of a personal body shield is not something that's terribly esoteric anymore. This is essentially what you're doing, is you are shrinking that energy bubble, Glenda's transportation spell if you want, down to you so that it's constant with your skin. And nothing can penetrate through it. It moves with you, it's reticulated, everything like that, okay? What this also does is that it is created from you, so you are intimately tied to it. If something hits it and is trying to penetrate it, you are going to know immediately, especially if you know yourself, okay? If you know that this vibration and this feeling is you, and then you feel it change instantly. Something just hits you and something is trying to get through your shields, so you know you need to start working and getting into a different mindset, possibly to defend yourself. Okay? With a ward, you just keep expanding it out until it encompasses the place you want it to be in. And then it shrinks down to be congruent with the boundaries of that area. Usually it's a room, sometimes it's an entire house, sometimes it's an entire property. Now, when you push it out that far, it's going to get very, very thin, because it's not going to break, it's not going to pop, it's just going to get really, really thin. So you have to start adding a whole bunch of extra energy to it to thicken it up and make it really armor-plated. Okay? And these are basic shields and wards. Okay? And that's all there is to it. You can say words, you can add things from constant energy sources, you can shrink it down to, you know, however you want to do it. You can make it dependent upon an object, you know, whatever rocks your boat, do, okay? But this is the basic structure, and this is how you should start, and then start experimenting with other things, all right? Once again, when you have the ward shrunk down to the boundaries of the area that you're in, you need to find a power source that is not you. A lot of people tend to hook it into the elements themselves, to earth and air and everything. Most people just hook it into the earth. There's a huge problem with doing that, though, and that is winter is coming. The earth goes to sleep when winter hits. Everything starts hibernating, and it goes into a low energy mode. So it doesn't have all that that free energy available to put into your wards. So during the winter time, guess what? They kind of tend to vanish at that point. I tend to hook it into the electrical system, so because there's a radiant energy around standard electrical systems that you can send Wi-Fi signals through, and that it can also be siphoned off for metaphysical energy, because metaphysical energy and electrical energy are damn near the same thing. Okay, I have fueled many a spell from my light socket. It's the weirdest thing, but it works. And when you stop and consider that lightning is used in metaphysical practices a lot worldwide, and that all lightning is static electricity, you go, why didn't I think of that?
It's true. And I vaguely remember actually, like, mentioned some time ago of charging spell by, like, basically either rubbing your feet on the floor, you know, if you've got socks or whatever, or using a balloon for the same purpose.
It's pretty
which,
cool.
Again, you know, ties into the same concept of static electricity being used as a fuel for spells.
All right. So, given that, one of the reasons that I'm really stressing this is there was a show on Sci-Fi Channel on cable a long time ago called Mad Mad House. In there, they had five people with alternative lifestyles who were around a whole bunch of normal, mundane people. And the competition was to see who was the most tolerant mundane. They had a voodoo priestess. They had a guy that does raw everything, raw vegetables. He's a vegetarian of some type, doesn't eat any meat, doesn't cook anything, thinks clothes are evil.
Doesn't eat anything that casts a shadow.
thinks clothes are evil. It was kind of interesting. They had an extreme tattooist and piercer who did suspension work. He was really cool. They had a vampire on there, or somebody that said he was a vampire. And they had Fiona Horn, a real live witch, on there. Now, I don't know if you guys remember this show or not, but there was one scene that just destroyed my credibility with, or Fiona's credibility with me as anything other than a complete poser. Because what happened was is that the voodoo priestess started having a ritual, and this was one of the challenges. And it was very heavy with Voodoo symbology, and there was a lot of energy work. The Loa were present. The mundanes were freaking out. They didn't understand what the hell was going on. The voodoo priestess was being ridden by one of the Loas, and Fiona freaked out. She absolutely lost it. She was shaking. She was she nearly lost consciousness a couple of times. She was in this altered state of consciousness, and she couldn't control it, and she didn't know what was going on. She had to leave, and she had to leave in a very public manner, the ritual, because it was too much for her. And I was screaming at the TV going, "Shields, bitch! You should have learned this the second day. Put a shield up, because that's what shields are for. They isolate you and insulate you from this stuff. If the energy is overwhelming you, put up a fucking shield." And she's like, "I'm an experienced witch." And I'm like, "No, you're fucking not." It was hilarious. Oh, God,
true.
I was so mad. But yes, the shields are there to insulate you from things like this. They also are there to contain the energy within you. Okay, just walking around the day, we shed that energy, like I was telling you. You know, it goes back into the ecosystem, other people get it. But if you're in a situation where you don't want other people's energy contaminating you, a shield is your best friend. Because what that does is it keeps your energy in you and their energy out there. It's a hazmat suit, a magical hazmat suit. That's the purpose of it.
It's a good comparison.
I mean, you really can't. That's the whole point of it, is to insulate you and to keep your energy in, so that you have it available to you. Now, the disadvantage of being shielded like this is, first off, you're a lot of the little clues that you get from energy states of other people, you're going to miss. You're not going to be as intuitive at this point, because you're not going to be able to be aware of the subtle energy shifts when they go from paying attention to what you're saying to in one ear and out the other. You're going to miss those unless you're really looking for them. So you have to be aware of that. You're also not going to be able to pull other people's energies to improve your mood. As part of you contaminating others and others contaminating you, we reach out with mental fingers all the time to friends, to frenemies, to coworkers, to people around us, and we draw off little bits of their energy and incorporate them into us to make us feel better. Because you can be having a bad day, you get around your best friend, you start chatting, you start having a good time, and you feel better. Well, that's you two swapping energy back and forth to improve each other's mood, okay? You're not going to be able to do that anymore if you have the shields up all the time, okay? This, because it insulates you, you're going to have your energy that's available, and that's it. Because you are isolated, you are insulated. So the solution to this is to drop your shields, right? No, it's not. Because it takes a little bit to get them up and back in place. The solution to it is to thin the shields down. To go from it being a wall, a brick wall, down to a skin of ice. To something, a gauzy veil. Okay? Where you can sense things through it. You can pull things in. But to be ready to make your shield that brick wall again if something is attacking you, like a coworker comes at you screaming at you because you messed up. Okay? So that's the concept that you want to have, and whatever visuals you use are fine. I find for me that there are crystalline structures that work better because they tend to be more durable. Other people find force fields from Star Trek to be, you know, the what they need. For a ward. Somebody else used the concept of the shield, the personal shields from Dune, the original one with Kyle MacLachlan, to be, you know, great. And, you know, whatever visuals, that's your visual, that's your business, and that's how you decide to use it. But whatever you do, you know, start using them, because that's what they're there for. Okay? Now, having gone through all of this, how do you take all of this energy that you've collected from the elements and channel it into a spell? Same way you channel any other energy into a spell. Okay? The process should go like this. You should get an idea of what the spell is you want to cast. You should have a very clear idea of what you want, the outcome, not the process. Not the how it's going to deliver it, but the outcome, the final product, okay? And then what you do is normally you would put your energy by envisioning it flowing into that idea and then going out into the universe to bring that idea to you, okay? That is typically the process. When you start having external sources of energy, like electricity, like the elements, like plants and whatever, you have an additional step in there. You have the clear idea of what you want. You spend some time communing with the various elements on their primitive magical level, however you wanted to see it, a torrential tornado, a flood, or, you know, a huge ocean with a giant wave coming up, however you want to see them. And you draw the energy into you at that point, still with the clear vision of what you want and what the final outcome is. Then, once you have all of that energy into you, then you feed it into the spell and then release it. Okay? It's the same process, just with an additional step in there of gathering the energy in. Okay? There's a few other items here that we need to talk about. And we're at hour 51 already. The first thing
we've run over time.
Yeah, well, we've run over time every single lesson. Okay, so we run over time more. Okay, power sinks, energy batteries, and charging items is all the same thing. Okay, there's a concept of a magical amulet where you charge it with your energies, and it never tells you how to do this. It's the same way as if you were casting a spell. Instead of having the clear idea of what you want, though, you have a clear idea of what you want this object to do. Be it protection, be it blessing, be it luck, or whatever. And you have that object in your hand or in your mind. You gather the energy again. You bring it in. And then you mentally push that energy into the physical object with that idea of what you want it to do. Okay, this is how you charge an amulet. This is how you charge a magical item. This is how you charge your athame or your cauldron or your staff or whatever. Okay, but there's a counterpart to this as well. And this is using your ritual tools as a power sink. We talked about grounding into all four elements. Let's say that you're really scattered after a ritual. You don't want to really lose this feeling, and there's all this additional energy that you don't want to just push away because you want to save it for another time. So you pick up a crystal off of your altar, and you push all of that extra energy into the crystal like you were charging it, and then you just set it down. This is a power sink now. It's an energy battery. What you've done is you've taken all that energy that you would normally just push back out into the earth, or into whatever element you want, and instead you've put it into a physical object where it will stay until you use it. Okay, you have to have a very clear idea of that it's going to stay there until you use it. And you put all of that extra energy in there, and that charges it up as a battery. Now when you need it, you know, for additional oomph later, all you do is you take that physical object, you pull all that energy out of it, and you have it available now. Okay? There is going to be some bleed off over time because this energy wants to cycle through everything. So it is going to lose some energy slowly over time, but if you keep recharging it and discharging it and recharging it, you're not going to notice it. It's not going to happen as often. And this item has now become a metaphysical battery for you. And it's always available. You can pull from it at any point in time as long as you know where it is. There is a downside to this, however, and that's if you lose this item, okay? Because you have been pushing your energy that is incorporated into you, let's back up for a second. We've talked about drawing the energy in. The energy comes into you from the elements, and it gets incorporated into your spiritual makeup. It stays there until you use it, but it's part of you. It is resonating with you. It is resonating to your aura. When you put it into something else, you are putting that vibration of you into that item. Okay? You can do it for charging items without that. And that's a whole nother procedure, and we're not going to talk about that today. We don't have time. But when you're charging a metaphysical battery, you're just dumping it into that object. Well, all of that energy still has your vibration laced all through it. If somebody else, who's also metaphysically aware, gets a hold of it, they can use that as a charm to get straight through all of your protections and into you. Okay, so these kinds of things you really want to be careful about leaving around. Okay, now if you have decided, like I have, that once it gets out of you, it no longer resonates with you, and it's no longer going to be able to be tracked back to you, that's great. They can't use it against you. Okay, but you really have to deep down in the bottom of your soul believe that once it leaves you, they can't get back to you. Okay? So that's those. The other thing that the other cautionary tale here that we wanted to talk about is all seven elements are there. Okay? They are truly neutral. They don't care about law and chaos, they don't care about good and evil. So they all have the potential to help and to destroy. And you really have to be aware of this dual nature and keep it in mind all the time, or else you can get into some severe trouble. Okay? The same air that is gently wafting over you and cooling you and making you feel good, that's letting you breathe, is the exact same air that destroyed the farmer's fields and barn and his house and tore up, you know, cattle and everything with the tornado. The same water that rains down on you and nourishes your fields is the same one that just wiped out an entire city on the coast because of a tsunami. Okay? This dual nature you have got to keep in mind, because if it gets away from you, it can go bad really, really quickly. That's why a lot of people tend to work with Earth more than with any of the other elements, because Earth is a hell of a lot more forgiving. Earth is one of those preponderous energies that sort of just lays there. It doesn't do anything. It is. It is there. It is the big pile in the room, and, you know, to get it to go to what you want it to do takes a hell of a lot of effort. And a lot of work, and a lot of patience, and a lot of cajoling, and a lot of moving, and a lot of rolling, okay? This is why, because it is just there. The problem is that once you get it rolling downhill, you don't want to be in front of it, because it's not going to stop until it gets to the bottom of the hill. And if you suddenly decide, once you get it rolling down the hill, that you didn't want it going there, oops. Because that's when you start winding up with things like earthquakes and mudslides and avalanches and things. Because you're not stopping it. It's going where you got it to go, and it's going to go there. The best you can do is try to mitigate it. You can try to deflect it some. But just like you had a hell of a lot of effort getting it going that direction in the first place, you're going to have a hell of a lot of effort deflecting it. Okay? But the other side of it is that it takes a lot to get it going in that direction in the first place. And usually, a lot before that, you'll realize that, no, this is not what I want to do, and you'll have a chance to correct it before you get it tipped over the edge of the hill. So that's why exactly. people tend to work with the Earth energy a lot more. Moon energy is very much like that as well. It's very preponderous. It's very clarified. And it tends to take a little bit to get it going. But once it's going, once again, you know, get the hell out of the way. Fire energy, any of the mutable elements. Air, I think, is mutable. They tend to be very, very fast to move. And very, very hard to control once it's going, and it can get away from you quickly. That's why, you know, teachers, spellcraft teachers, are very, very clear on you want to have an exact idea of what you want this spell to do before you ever start it. If it takes getting a chart out and drawing, you know, lines and correspondences and everything and possible consequences of this, do that. But you want to have a clear idea of what you're doing before you ever start the process, because once it's started, there are times when it's very, very hard to change it. Okay? So that's it. Brian, do you have stuff?
No, you've covered pretty much everything. I mean, basically, with magic, you just you try it, and you know, there are a lot of basic guides that will tell you, you know, certain safe precautions to take, and you know, do take them, but don't build yourself so much in a sense of fear that, you know, you end up scaring yourself into not trying it. Sometimes you're going to make mistakes. Things are going to unfold in ways you didn't predict.
And you know what? That's part of life.
That's the way of life. That's exactly it. Life happens, you know, and with magic, your effectiveness will increase as you practice more and more. But, you know, don't jump into the really advanced stuff until you've taken baby steps, because otherwise you're going to unleash the tsunami where you meant to steer a creek, you know, like take steps, grow in skill, uncover the associations and particular talents that you have, because not everyone is going to be skilled at, you know, protection spells or love spells or, you know, curses or whatever. Mm-hmm. Each of us is granted a particular knack. So through trying different things, you're going to discover the ones that you have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and don't be afraid to try some of this stuff. I mean, I've seen a lot of grimoires and a lot of basic 101 texts that, you know, oh, don't do a love spell because you can't cancel it, and this person might become a stalker, and it's taken away their free will. And that's great to scare you, but that's, you know, that's the Old Testament laws, the thou shalt not, okay? These are the advanced rules. You can try. You can always fix it. It may not be fixable the way you want it to be fixed, but you can always fix it. You just have to be willing to make those sacrifices if you must. For instance, let's say you cast a love spell and the person is absolutely smitten with you and they're stalking you and they won't leave you alone, and the more they're around you, the worse it gets, okay? Now, conventional wisdom in the book says, okay, you must, you know, cast this counter spell and you must really believe it. Well, you do that and it doesn't work, okay? And now all those, you shall not, comes back to you. You know, I shouldn't have cast a love spell because it's terrible. But here's the thing. There's still the extreme measures and the extreme countermeasures that you haven't tried yet. Move. Move to another city. Move to another state. They won't be around you anymore.
Change your phone number. I mean,
change your name. You know, if it's really that bad, talk to the police. There's stalking laws. You know, that's the solution. It's not a magical solution. It's not the first solution. It's not the best solution. But it is a solution. And it can be fixed by getting them away from you. That's the goal.
Exactly.
You know, it's like I tell people, my clients that come to me with computer problems, you know, I don't know anything about using a computer. And I'm like, I didn't know anything about using a computer either. You know what I did? I got in and I started playing with it. I deleted files. I had to rewipe my computer and reload everything. I screwed it up. I broke it to a point where I didn't think could be fixed. That's what you got to do with magic, okay? It can always be fixed. Sometimes the fixes are more extreme than you want, but it's a fix.
Definitely. And, I mean, realistically, too, the way you expect things to unfold is not going to be predictable. You know, there's courses of events that will take your spell and put it into action and manifest whatever it is you desire, but you don't assume that you have an idea of what's supposed to happen. It's quite popular when people have chosen to subscribe to the threefold law that Wiccans, you know, promote, to say that you shouldn't specifically seek a particular lover, but rather should be more generic about it so that whatever unfolds, you know, the right lover is going to come along. Okay, you know, if that's what you want to do, go for it. A lot of the older grimoires don't do that.
There's a trend in modern paganism to make it as light as possible. But remember, we're coming from centuries of human want, need, and desire, and witchcraft is based on manifesting what you want in your life. Okay, it's not about the fluffy bunny light, universe is a friendly place. It's about, I want cash for this car, and I'm going to get it. Here's a spell for me to do that. I want this lover to go away and leave me alone forever, and if they have to die, so be it. Okay, that's what witchcraft and magic is. It is not the light crap that is sent out by quite a lot of authors these days. That is a sop to the predominant religion in Western society of Christianity to say, see, we're really not bad people. We're good people, and we do good things. So leave us alone, please. Go ahead, Brian.
Well, yeah, I mean, realistically, you know, choosing a particular hindrance, let's call it, in a particular morality, I guess, is a choice that you make. You know, magic doesn't really subscribe to those rules. And personally, I find that in my own spells, I tend to just go for the direct route, you know, straight for the jugular kind of deal, instead of trying to accommodate, you know, some self-chosen morality system that says, oh, you know, don't do it this way. Basically, I just go with the result I want and let things unfold as they're gonna, you know, if that means that things happen unpredictably, that, you know, there are consequences I didn't foresee, that probably is my own irresponsibility. But you'll actually, if you read Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea books, she talks about the concept of only using magic if you understand the consequences, good and bad, through the course of time that will happen as a result of what you've done. That, in my mind, that makes sense. It's more about personal responsibility than it is a moral system. Mm-hmm.
Good examples of this in popular media. There's Buffy the Vampire Slayer. There's always unforeseen consequences in that. And, you know, sometimes she winds up getting hurt pretty badly. But the one I'm thinking of is Practical Magic with Sandra Bullock in it. Where there's a lady that comes and wants her lover to love just her and only her and to be addicted to her, and the aunts are going, are you sure you want to do this? And the lady's absolutely certain, and he becomes so addicted to her that she can't get away from him. She can't divorce him. He is on her all the time. He is obsessive about her. She can't go any place or do anything. And, you know, it's unforeseen consequences. And,
well,
you know,
and that's the whole premise of the movie, right? Like, that one sister has cast a love spell on this boyfriend of hers who becomes obsessive and controlling and who ultimately desires her so strongly that he's brought back from the grave as this compulsive, like, love-obsessed revenant who basically won't leave her alone, and he possesses her because he wants her so badly. You know, this is how things can progress. You kind of have to take that into consideration if you're going to manipulate people. But don't feel that you have to, that you're only truly a spellcaster if you subscribe to a moral system first. There's not really a lot of older authors who ever promote that.
Yeah, one of the things that I started doing in one of the classes that I was teaching, it was about morality and the morality of witchcraft. And the problem that I proposed was, okay, you have a child who has been, who is, you know, 24 months old. They're very young. They can't make decisions for themselves. who has been diagnosed with a brain tumor. And it's a very fatal brain tumor. There is no hope of the child recovering from this. The child, however, is showing absolutely none of this. They're happy, they're bouncy, they're joyful, they smile, they laugh, they kick their feet. There's no pain involved. The doctors are saying that the child is going to die fairly at some point. They don't know when. The parents are grief-stricken and just losing it because the child is in the hospital now, and they come to you to help. Now, as a moral witch, as a spellcaster, as a Wiccan, as a priest or priestess of your gods, what do you do? Do you try to heal the child? Do you try to help the child die quickly? Do you help the parents rather than the child? Do you bless the hospital and the doctors? What do you do at that point? And there was, you know, all kinds of back and forth and people asking questions about the situation and trying to come up with a solution, one that was moral and right. And the point of the entire exercise was to make a decision on a moral point, morally ambiguous point, stick to it, and to defend it. That was all. It wasn't to have a good moral point. It wasn't to have a right morality. It wasn't to do the right thing for somebody. It was to make a decision and stick there. And that's what you have to do with this. You have to make a decision on some morally ambiguous point, and you have to go, okay, I've made this decision. This is comfortable for me. I'm going to live with the consequences, and I'm going to go on from here. There you go.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, yeah, the whole morality of magic is a choice that you make. If you want to get involved with it, try it. You know, if you don't, then don't. You know, nobody's forcing you. It would be weird if your particular teacher, if you're a Wiccan, has told you that magic and ritual are inseparable and you can't be a Wiccan without witchcraft itself, because witchcraft predates Wicca, and it really is just a practice that fits into any religion.
Unfortunately,
you know, there's
tools. Sorry, I hate to interrupt, unfortunately there's many modern authors, Scott Cunningham and Mike Nichols among them, who propose you can't be a witch unless you do witchcraft, or you can't be a Wiccan unless you do, unless you do witchcraft.
Buckland uses, in Wicca for one, Buckland uses the words witchcraft and Wicca interchangeably, as though they are the same thing.
But his philosophy...
It's probably just been handed down.
Yeah. His philosophy, and I've talked to him about this, is that witches are Wiccan. It is a craft that is taught side by side with Wicca in the traditions that he promotes, so that this subset of Wiccans that are tutored by him are witches as well. Now, he is willing to admit that there is the religion of Wicca and there is the craft of witches, and they are separate, just like there is the religion of Christianity and there is the craft of carpentry. Okay? They are separate. And you can have one without the other. Unfortunately, like I was saying, Mike Nichols and Cunningham combine the two and say Wicca is witchcraft, witchcraft is Wicca, you cannot separate them. And, you know, I've had debates with Mike Nichols on this. We had articles going back and forth over the internet on this very point. And, you know, we finally came to the point of, well, we're both right. I see your side of it, I don't agree with it. You see my side of it, you don't agree with it. We're going to agree to disagree and still be friends. You know?
Yes, and that's the big key, right? Like, there are going to be different opinions, and ultimately you're going to have to agree that everyone is entitled to an opinion and that none of you is right or wrong. So, again, so, do magic okay. if you want. Don't do it if you don't.
It's that simple. But hopefully this 2 hours and 15 minutes has helped somebody out there. Don't be afraid to ask questions. We love to get feedback. Joy@magicalmusings.net, Brian@magicalmusings.net, our website, magicalmusings.net, oddly enough. We have our personal Tumblrs at wide-worlds-joy.tumblr.com. There is cosmic-rebirth.tumblr.com. We love getting feedback. We love hearing, share, you know, these with other people, tell them about it, have them come listen. We always try to make sure that we have the you listeners in mind as we do this. I mean, it's a lot of us talking back and forth and talking over each other, but the point is to educate y'all. And so if it helps, fantastic. If you have a little extra cash, toss it our way. We'll appreciate it.
Indeed. Because, yes, unfortunately, there is the matter of financial obligations for this kind of thing. And, you know, a little donation here or there doesn't hurt, might be of use to us. And with the feedback, folks, don't be afraid to say negative things, provided that you can offer constructive criticism. We do like to know what you actually think. If you disagree, if you think we're complete morons, you know, if you just want to correct a point or two, please do.
If you want to add to our base of knowledge,
your constant praise.
No. Constructive criticism, negative feedback is just as useful as positive feedback. It's great when we get, hey, you guys rock, y'all do everything, but it's more useful to hear, okay, you messed up on this point when you were talking about Asatru, and you didn't remember that this point came from Zoroastrianism, and, you know, we may ask you on the show to, you know, go over points like that. This is what we want. We're not all-knowing, even though we try to pretend to be. Anyhow.
Yes, it's true. And we do kind of want to have guests to interact, too. So by all means, if you are a long-time practitioner of something or other, and you think it would fit under the blanket of magical musings, then by all means, you know, hit us up. Maybe we can have you on a show and talk about something you do.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a chance to promote books and things like that. So anyway, I think that's going to be it. That's over our 2-hour self-imposed
limit.
That's
a very long show.
Yes, it is. So talk to you all next week. Next show is going to be our Beltanya show. The one after that, I don't know. Maybe we'll talk about ethics or something. I don't know. But it's going to be interesting, so tune in then.
Absolutely. Have a good night, folks.
Take care, everyone. Bye.